Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast, coming from Dallas, Texas and Sacramento, California. Here's Skylar Teo and David Stauffer.
Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast. From Los Angeles, California, I am joined once again by the Aaron Alvarado.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it. And just to let you know, there's a Donkey Kong kill screen coming up, if you're interested. There is a Donkey Kong kill screen coming up.
Okay, well, let's pause this pod. Let's. I love that. Teasing one of the movies on your list. Oh, I can't wait to talk about that. Such a good scene. So I talked about this in the last pod, and we're here to do it. We're here to talk about documentaries. The reason why we're doing that is when we did our top 10 films of 2015 pod, you had one documentary on your list. I chose not to list any. There were a few that I liked. The Amy Winehouse documentary, Listen to Me Marlon, about Marlon Brando. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to have it as, I don't know whether it was a separate category or for whatever reason, I decided not to include any docs on my list. And so today we're here to talk about one doc in particular that came out in 2015, directed by Colin Hanks. And then we have five documentary recommendations, essentially, that aren't just from 2015, but from, you know, really any year. And our approach here wasn't necessarily a top five of all time docs, but maybe five what we feel like are underappreciated docs. We're kind of positioning this as recommendations. And so that's kind of how it's going to go. Now, I do want to talk about one thing before we jump into our docs. And that is Hail Caesar. I'm kidding. You haven't seen Hail Caesar yet, have you?
I have not, but I'm looking forward to it. I'm a huge Coen Brothers fan. So yeah, it's definitely on my list of things to check out soon.
Good. Well, I'm going to need you to, because we're going to be recording a podcast this week. You, me, and Skylar.
Oh boy.
Yeah. B-Mort will also be on as well. He'll be on, but he's going to be on Do Not Disturb mode. So you probably won't hear a word of him. for that reference there, we have a text thread going on between Aaron, Skylar, B-Mort, and myself. And I think it got a little bit too much for B-Mort, so he turned it on to Do Not Disturb, so we don't hear from him anymore.
I can't blame him. Some of those things
No, I didn't. He did jump in once. He decided to check and jump in, and it was really great because he jumped in to warn us about what we were talking about because, and I kid you not, the NSA might be listening.
If Eric Snowden taught us anything, it's that they are listening. So thanks, B-Mort, for the reminder.
What's great about that is it's Edward Snowden.
Sorry,
that's what I love about
that.
No, it's great. He's made such a cultural impact.
I was actually thinking about putting Citizen 4 on my top five recommendation. It's a really good documentary, but it kind of got edged out by several other ones that should be viewed first.
But I think that's worth mentioning, though, because I also had Citizen 4 on my longer list. It won the documentary last year for best, or excuse me, it won the Oscar last year for best documentary. So I would think a lot of people have heard of this film by now, and they should see it if they haven't, because it's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
Thanks to him, we know that the NSA is listening in on our text conversations. It's just funny to me that, like, without even giving anyone any context, to think that we were even having any type of conversation that would be interesting to the NSA. And this is, I'm going to be honest with you. This is part of my marketing play here is I kind of want some NSA people to subscribe to the podcast.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah. I want them to listen in, hear what we're talking about, and think, you know what? Let's take a listen. Maybe these guys are some sort of like sleeper cell. Or something, and let's listen to their episodes and see if we can like find some sort of coded language in which we speak.
Oh, there's always
this is the way, right? Like this is how we get our message out, you know. And so
the most dangerous podcast in the world is what I think you should.
That's what I want. I want to be at least allegedly right. And maybe they listen, and maybe they start to fall in love with the pod, and they just become fans. I know it's kind of a roundabout way to get new view listenerships, but like whatever. I'll do whatever it takes. Anyway, so shout out to B-Mort, but we're going to do the Hail Caesar pod, top five Coen Brothers film coming this next week, which is going to be incredibly difficult, like all these top five lists are.
I would say it's almost impossible to top five with Coen.
Yeah. So, and I saw Hail Caesar yesterday, and I'll withhold my opinion for now, save it for the pod. But look for that as our next episode. What I did actually want to talk about, not Hail Caesar, was the Iowa caucus was finished up this past week, and I know
quite a debacle.
We don't want to get too political, but the reason why slightly relevant here is because they're going to make a movie about this this election. How could they not?
I think they should just limit it to an SNL movie. Just do an SNL parody.
Well, Bernie Sanders was just with Larry David.
Yeah.
Was it Burn Your Enthusiasm?
It's very funny. That was actually one of the funnier things that SNL has done in a very long time. So
yeah, it was really, really great. But I'm like, when it comes to politics, I have ideology that's really kind of all across the board. I certainly have some conservative viewpoints. I definitely have liberal viewpoints, which makes it impossible when choosing a candidate not to feel like you're compromising in some crazy way. So every single candidate holds views that I strongly disagree with, and that's the reality. But I'm pretty jaded when it comes to, like, the political process, the two party systems. I don't fit into either one. It's kind of frustrating for me. I'm a registered voter in the state of California, so it doesn't really matter what I vote, because it's in the presidential election, at least, it always is going to be one way. And if I were to change to Utah, it's the same thing.
Right.
It's always
going to
be one way. And so I'm mostly jaded. But this is, for the first time I can remember, this is an election where we have the DNC and the RNC clearly have their picked candidates. In the RNC's case, I think there's probably two that they consider like the established party establishment candidates that they're going to be pushing with all their might to get the nomination. And for the first time ever, those people that they picked aren't necessarily the people that the actual public want.
Isn't that funny?
And it's caused total chaos in both the DNC and the RNC, to the point that the DNC has they've had their person picked for 8 years and longer than that. And people are coming out, you know, in droves for an alternative candidate that they don't want. They refuse to have a certain number of debates. And when they do, they put it in a schedule, the time slot on TV where it's like not prime time. No one's watching Saturday night, you know.
It's every trick in the book. And it's interesting. You can actually see how it's playing out. And it's really blatant. Interesting to watch, man. It's fun, actually.
And then did you say it's fun?
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely.
It's totally fun. Because I mean our current system, RNC and DNC, the whole party establishment on both sides, it's something I kind of revolt against, or I revile, I should say. And it's so I love seeing them in disarray. I love the chaos. I don't love personally the candidate Donald Trump. I do think the chaos is hilarious. Same goes for Cruz. I certainly am not a big fan of a lot of his viewpoints, and he's not who the RNC wants, and it's causing chaos. Anyway, so it's just a blast to watch. But my favorite moment of the week, and I can't wait to see how this plays out in the made-for-TV movie that HBO does, is when the day of the Iowa caucus, Ben Carson goes home to get a fresh change of clothes. Did you hear the story?
I didn't, actually.
Oh, it's unreal. So most candidates at the Iowa caucus, they'll stick around that day, whatever, and they move on to New Hampshire immediately, right, to the next campaign. And so Ben Carson doesn't immediately go to New Hampshire. He goes home for a 24-hour period for what his campaign said in a statement was to get a fresh change of clothes, which you would have brought with you, I think, to Iowa, or maybe purchased in any local Iowa Walmart, Target, anything. But anyway, that's not even the story. What's funny is he leaves. CNN reports that it's unusual for a candidate not to immediately go to New Hampshire, but to go home for 24 hours is just an unusual move. So Ted Cruz, essentially Ted Cruz's campaign informs all of their different staffers throughout Iowa, the different, you know, the caucus locations throughout the state.
Yeah, yeah.
They have them all make an announcement right before voting that they said something to the effect of While it hasn't been made public yet, it's just about to break. But Ben Carson has decided to suspend his campaign for presidency. And we think it'd be important for you guys to know that before you cast your votes. It's only fair that you understand that, like, he won't be running for president. It's decided. It just hasn't been public yet. At any second now, they're going to announce that right before voting.
That's incredible.
And, I mean, Ben Carson wasn't going to win anyway. And sure, it wasn't going to win, like, a ton of delegates anyway. But it was a clear, like, just a clear, dirty politics. Like, like, just anything you could do to snatch up those extra delegates. But, dude, man just wants a fresh change of clothes. Like,
And it takes him a full 24 hours, which is
a
little odd, I guess.
Well, he probably had to wash him. Yeah, I don't know. Whatever.
Sure.
But
what do you think really happened? What do you think was happening over that full day period?
I've thought about it because clearly that's not the actual real reason. No. I don't know. It could have been something of a private nature. Like, I wonder if something was going on with his family. I don't know if he has kids or something like that, but what if there was some issue going on that he needed to address that something wouldn't have been appropriate or to make public or would have been anyone's business? I wonder if it was some family thing like that, or if he really was having a moment where he had to, like kind of give himself 24 hours to think about whether or not it was worth continuing to campaign, considering the most recent polling data that day showed that he was going to get very few, if any, delegates or votes.
Yeah. That's what I would lean towards. I mean, I don't know anything, but it seems like that would be the case.
Well, campaigning seems like it'd be exhausting, and I wouldn't want to do a minute longer than I had to.
No way. Not a chance. What was the deal with the whole walking out confusion thing? Did you see that video?
Oh, yeah, I did watch that video. Favorite video of the week. My favorite thing I've watched this week is the clip of them coming out, being introduced in the Republican debate. Because it's just a metaphor for how the entire, the entire campaign's gone. Complete chaos.
Did they introduce the wrong candidate and then they sent out the wrong one?
So it started with Ben Carson. And so he's
of course, everything starts with him.
Yeah. By the way, he's still campaigning, by the way. Definitely didn't suspend his campaign. It started with him, but then people, few people after him make the exact same mistake, so it's not all on him, but it did start with him. But it was so loud in there that they're all coming from around the corner, and he comes around the corner just after they had said his name to come out.
Yeah.
And the corner is just kind of a little foyer area where he waits. So he turns the corner and stands there to wait, but he doesn't realize they just said his name.
Okay.
And then they say, like, the next name, I think, was Ted Cruz. And Ted Cruz comes around the corner, like, past him. And they look at each other like, wait, what? Did they skip you? Like, and then the same thing happens to Trump. And then, like, there's a backup where it's, like, Trump and Ben Carson and someone else. And then Jeb passes all of them. And he just, like, gives Trump this, like, dirty glare. I mean, it was, like, amazing to watch.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think what's funny is I think it was just an honest mistake. I think it was really loud and they couldn't hear anything. I mean, yeah, but it was just really, really funny to watch. Anyway, this is I love everything about this campaign. Oh, also the, and I won't probably talk too much about this, but Ted Cruz sent, I guess people have done this, both Democrats and Republicans, but he sent mailings out to this, like, citizens of Iowa that this document that says voter violation. That there's expected low voter turnout in that area, and that they're going to publicly release if they voted or not in the caucus, and they have a list of their neighbors, the actual neighbors' names, and they give them grades on how on the past if they voted or not, and they're like all Fs, and they're like 55%, because studies have shown that the most motivating factor in getting someone to vote is social pressure.
Wow.
And so they send these papers to people, and apparently it's legal. Just really, really messed up.
Yeah, I could see that.
That says, yeah, if you don't vote, everyone's going to know it. it's crazy. This stuff's crazy. Anyway, I think it's hilarious. I can't wait for the movie.
It's going to be a great movie. I just wonder who's going to direct it and who's going to write it. It's got to be Sorkin, right, that writes it?
Oh, yeah, Sorkin's already right. He certainly has it. I mean, every week is a new chapter. He's writing it as he goes. Who's going to direct it? I want the guy that directed The Late Shift to direct.
Oh, jeez. That's a good choice.
Yeah, and we got Daryl Hammond to play Trump.
Oh, yeah. So, he could definitely pull it off. And how about James Adomian as Bernie Sanders?
It's perfect.
Yeah. In those videos, Bernie Sanders versus Trump, I don't like the guy who's playing Trump. I don't know who that guy is, but I don't think he's very good.
Oh yeah. Well, he doesn't. Certainly doesn't look like him.
No, I just don't think that he can pull it off. Yeah. Maybe it's just the fact that Adomian does it. He does Bernie Sanders so well.
Yeah.
That anyone else compared to him is just poor. So.
I think trying to pull off Trump is way more difficult than people would realize because. Yeah. People are just used to doing caricatures, but when you're doing a caricature of what's already a caricature, like
right, exactly.
it's already funny. It's already is a caricature of yeah. someone like, and so what do you do? What, I don't know. I find it fascinating because you could just act exactly like him and it's comedy gold.
Sure.
You don't have to exaggerate a single thing. Like in the debate, and I watch all the debates the most part. I've skipped maybe a couple, but in this past debate, Trump gets booed by the crowd, okay, at one point. And the boos continue to get louder. And he waves off the crowd and dismisses them by saying, and he says, like, essentially speaking to the television audience, yeah. Like people watching from home, that everyone in the crowd is just a donor. They're not actual real voters. Fox News told them right beforehand that it's only donors in the audience. And since he's the one that's not taking donations from like the big donors, they all hate him. So don't listen to the boos. And he's just being drowned out by these boos. I'm like, this is amazing.
Wow. Is that the first time he was booed? Because I feel like everyone always loved him whenever he was at the debates.
Yeah. I think when he makes certain points, he certainly gets like loud applause, right? But there's been a precedent for the boos.
Really?
There are moments where he's booed. Yeah, he shushes Jeb Bush in this one. it's really surreal. In the middle of him trying to make a point about eminent domain, he shushes Jeb Bush, and that's when the boos start. And it's just, yeah, man, that guy, it's amazing.
Well, I think it's a great point to point out how entertaining this is. It's a parallel to why documentaries can be so entertaining and so
totally.
So fascinating. I mean, it's real life, and real life is just so much more interesting than dramatic films.
It really is. And that's a great point. Documentaries to me, when I think of my interest in film, and especially in the part of actually producing it and creating it, I personally want to make documentary films. That's where I feel like that's where I'm most interested. I also think that's where my at least worldview and current skill set matches most. I don't know that I'd be a very effective like kind of narrative filmmaker in a lot of ways. But documentaries is what really intensely interests me, and that's what I want to make no matter what job I have.
Well, let's just talk for a second about your documentary, Erasmo.
Oh, is this on your five? No. Oh,
it's number six. I was going to put number five. No, honestly, just as a documentary film fan, a movie, a short like Erasmo is exactly what I'm looking for. It's a subject that I had no interest in. He's a character that I had no knowledge of. And the way you present him is just, it's fascinating, man. You just give us a peek into his life, into his method, his philosophy. And it's gripping, and it's really effective, and you did a great job on it, and I just can't give you enough praise. I mean, you really did a fantastic job on that one. Anyone out there, go look for Erasmo. It's a fantastic little short documentary.
Yeah, I do have a site. First off, thank you for the praise. That is not what I was not expecting. That I do really appreciate that. If you go to erasmo.us, just erasmo.us. That's Erasmo, Erasmo. It's a documentary of short, under 10-minute documentary I did on a Mexican sculptor named Erasmo Fuentes. So if anyone's interested in seeing what Aaron was just referencing. It ended up playing at a film festivals in L.A., Utah, in Long Island, New York, in Maine and New Hampshire. So
very
it's,
cool.
Before I decided to stop submitting to random small to medium sized film festivals. I mean, this wasn't exactly opening Toronto. But that's what I want to do, right? That's my dream is to, you know, continue my career in what I'm currently doing. But to always be looking for subjects that are fascinating enough to document. And I'm most interested in like the everyday life people that never would have a spotlight otherwise. That's the most fascinating stuff to me.
Always. Same here. And, you know, that's what really got me into documentary, the genre, when I was younger. It's just like you take a look at a subject that you don't know much about most of the time, and you find these interesting characters that some of them you can relate to, some of them are just way out of your realm of understanding, and those also are compelling, and it just drags you along for this ride, and it's so fun to take part in. And for me, as we go into the list of movies here, some of these, they hit me when I was younger. I was introduced to it as I was younger, and they kind of formed my vision of what a great documentary is. And I feel like I compare new documentaries to these ones that kind of established this baseline for me when I was younger. So,
well, what's great is we're in the golden age of documentaries, and we have Definitely. Been for the past little while. And I'm sure that's attributed to several things. Certainly, documentaries historically are not moneymakers, and they still aren't really moneymakers, more so now than ever. But the technology and the accessibility of that technology, I think, has allowed people to be able to make more documentaries, and certainly on a much smaller budget. And because of that, we've been getting the most fascinating stuff. Absolutely. I mean, as a kid growing up, I feel like documentaries I associated with what I was shown in school, and all of that was boring. And as a kid, I think generally probably you're going to find documentaries boring until you start to really experience life and you find what's so fascinating in documentaries. But right now, I mean, it's just every year there's going to be five great documentaries that come out, at least.
You can count on it.
And then a whole bunch more that are really good. And Netflix has made that accessibility in terms of viewing it made it all the more popular. It's an exciting time for documentaries.
It really is. And even like YouTube. I mean, if you go on YouTube, you can find these documentaries that didn't get any play. They're completely independent. Yeah. Some guy and a camera has just found this interesting subject and decided to film it. Like, just one day I randomly stumbled across this one about a barbershop. Like, this was all about this guy's, he was a small business owner. He created his own barbershop, and this was like a 15-minute documentary on his life. It was fascinating. This guy, I mean, the YouTube maybe had 20,000 views, the video itself. So it's like, this obviously didn't make any money. They didn't put any money into the budget. It was just a guy, a camera, and his subject. Yeah. And it was compelling for 15 minutes. So, and that's the power of really interesting storytelling via documentary.
Yeah, it really is. I remember when Lindsay and I lived in New York. We lived in the Upper East Side, and we went to a Yankees game. The A's were in town, so I went to Yankee Stadium to catch my Oakland A's. And on the way back down, taking the subway back, we get off. We're kind of near Harlem before the Upper East Side, and I need a haircut. You saying barbershop made me think of this, haircuts. I'd went to a couple places. We hadn't lived in New York for very long, and we weren't ultimately there for very long, but 4 months. But I went to a couple places to get my haircut, and they were like $60 to $80 or something like that. And I was like, oh yeah, no way. So I didn't, I was like, nope. And so anyway, I'm walking down the street, and this old man comes out of his barbershop. This old Italian man speaks very broken English and stops me. His name was Pietro. And he tells me I need a haircut. So he's being a good like salesman. And I was like, I do, but like, how much? And he says $20. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'll pay $20. So I go in there with him, and he cuts my hair, starts talking about his life story and all about how he started the business and his clientele and how he gets it and how all the recurring people and the technology and the weird method in which he used, which I'd never had my haircut like that before. It was so fascinating to get a glimpse of this guy's life that the rest of the time I was in New York, I got my haircut from him and I wanted badly to just spend a few hours or a day shooting him in his shop and do a small little piece on it. And that's what's great is because I have a DSLR with me and I have a monopod, I have the right audio equipment that, I can easily do that and have it not cost me very much.
Definitely.
And so, anyway, that's the thing. You're right. You can go on YouTube and find stuff like that all the time. It's crazy. It's really, it's awesome. So what started this whole thing is you and I just recently watched this Colin Hanks documentary. It's called All Things Must Pass, and it's about the rise and fall of Tower Records, which might not seem like the most fascinating topic at the start. Most people have heard of Tower Records and have been inside of one and know that it was a massive record chain, you know, international, just international chain of stores that's sold records and then cassettes and then CDs and all sorts of stuff. And it started in Sacramento. So I've been following this for a while. Colin Hanks was born and raised in Sacramento. He's, of course, Tom Hanks' son from Tom Hanks' first marriage. And so he was raised by his mom in Sacramento. He used to talk about how when he got older and he would travel with his dad internationally, you know, whether in Japan or in Europe or even in New York, he would see Tower Records and it would remind him of Sacramento, which is where Tower Records started. So it was founded by a group of people from Sacramento, and the location of where that store, the very, very first store started, is still there. It's a Tower Theater, which is actually where I saw The Hateful Eight when I was in town, which is really the spot for independent cinema in Sacramento today. But anyway, so Colin Hanks has been making this documentary about how it started in Sacramento, and then, you know, how everything kind of fell apart from, I mean, they were doing $1 billion in revenue at one point, and then not long after were bankrupt, essentially, or liquidated. And it's something he's been making for the past like 5 to 7 years, and he finally released it in the kind of last quarter of 2015, and it's finally accessible. So I was excited to watch it, and so you watched it recently too. What did you think?
Yeah, the Tower Records story I wasn't really aware of. I had been to Tower Records when I was living in Sacramento a couple times. It seemed like a really interesting, cool store. But I feel like the story of the rise and fall of Tower Records is actually, you can tie it to the rise and fall of the CD or the recorded music in general. It wasn't just Tower Records that fell. The entire industry took a nosedive. And so I could totally relate, you know, all the record stores that I did go to. You know, they're very similar in what they offered to Tower Records. But, you know, watching the story is really fascinating, hearing how it was just a little seedling and how it grows from the seedling to this gigantic, monolithic entity that, like you said, went all over the world, unfortunately, to its detriment. You find out that they made a lot of poor decisions in expanding so fast. But they were dreamers. The main guy, I can't remember his name at the moment.
Russ Solomon.
Yeah, Solomon. Yeah, he was a dreamer. I mean, that was the thing. He had this vision, and he was relentless, and he always chased after it. And through the help of all these people that he molded, he reached for the stars, and you know, he got it. Like you said, they made $1 billion. That's crazy.
That's the thing that's crazy to me here. Yeah. Russ Solomon is a dude that is helping his dad at work his tower drugstore, or mm-hmm. whatever it was, and eventually started selling records on the side inside this pharmacy or whatever, and then got to the point where he could open his own store. But what's amazing to me is that this dude didn't come from necessarily a major business background. Now, he learned a lot along the way, of course.
Yeah.
But like the people he also surrounded himself with, for the most part, with a couple notable exceptions, were not people with business backgrounds.
No.
I mean, a lot of these were young kids that learned along the way and then eventually became senior vice presidents and in these huge leadership positions of this global chain. And the fact that they can, it's like they were untouchable. It kept growing and growing. And hearing the stories of Russ talking about how he was in San Francisco, looked across the street, and there's this empty building, and he's like, oh, let's put one there, like, calls the number, makes the deal on the phone, and then they have a San Francisco location.
Right.
You can't do that anymore. But like the fact that, it's inspiring to see a dreamer like that without any real business education in like a traditional sense, be able to have so much success. Now, of course, eventually that bubble popped,
right?
You know, and that had to do with technology and poor decision making. I mean, I don't think there was ever a way that they were going to avoid what eventually happened. It would have been delaying the inevitable, but
They had a great run though. I mean, what was it, 40 years or something like that? Almost 40 years. What I found really interesting was in the beginning they talk about how there was a real connection to the city. that was the hub for all the teenagers in the area. Yeah. I mean, everyone wanted to be at Tower Records, that very first store. Like, they would hang out in the parking lot, and they would, you know, just, that would be the spot on Friday nights and Saturday nights. You would just go to Tower Records. And I thought that was really cool to see that, how it just organically happened like that. So
yeah, and that's, and they were somehow able to maintain that type of kind of communal family type feel and hangout feel in so many of those stores that they opened. Like, it was a hangout, and the people that worked there, like, all the, you get this, you know, section of the documentary about all the stuff they were doing, like, in the back room and stuff like that. Right. I mean, these were, this was a hangout for the employees and the people that went in. I remember going in there to get my Weezer cassettes, or I remember getting Thriller on, you know, my cassette tape there at Tower Records in Sacramento. And, like, I mean,
which location did you go to? Which location was it?
Yeah, I went to a location on Sunrise, in Sacramento. It was near the Sunrise Mall, just across the street from the Sunrise Mall.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Okay, yeah, that was the spot that I would go. That was the closest one that made sense. I mean, there was a Dimple Records that was a little bit closer, mm-hmm. but I preferred Tower for sure. Because I knew, the reason why I did that is, even as, like, a, you know, younger kid and even into high school, is that I could trust the people that worked there. Not just, you know, for a variety of things, like, but certainly to point me in the direction of good music, and it had this feel to it that really did feel like it's hard to, they articulate it so well in the documentary, but it does feel like a safe place for people to just come in, enjoy good music, take your time, hang out. And for a place like Sacramento, especially when it first started decades ago, you know, there weren't exactly a lot of hot spots, you know, the state exactly. capital, no one's hanging out in the parking lot of the state capital. So it became that Watt Avenue story he talks about, which is so crazy for them to watching this documentary, seeing Dave Grohl and Bruce Springsteen mm-hmm. and Elton John talk about how much they liked Tower Records. And in Dave Grohl's case, actually working there. It's so fascinating seeing that, and then referencing the map of where the stores were in Sacramento, which is where I grew up. Right. Speaking of which, amazing that they got those big names in there, and I'm so grateful they did not, like, overuse them.
Sure.
Still focused on Russ Solomon and the people who started the company, a bunch of no names that most people wouldn't recognize or know.
Exactly. That's the heart and soul of it. And, you know, totally. I think today, especially if you're in the corporate environment, the one thing that you hear constantly drilled home is culture. All right. So culture is, like, the number one thing that you talk about. And if you look at this documentary, there was no talk of culture. It was just there. It was just there.
Totally organic.
It just happened. Yeah. Yeah. So, I thought that was really fascinating how they hit on that. And they weren't even necessarily trying. It just happened. So it's pretty interesting.
So when it finally, which, by the way, there's still 85 or some odd locations in throughout Japan still, because that's a separate, you know, I guess, part of the franchise.
Did they just sell off the name? Is that what it is? Or
is something like that? Yeah. The name and the brand, and there's some sort of deal that allowed them to carry on. When it finally came to a close and everything was liquidated in the United States, that Sacramento store, like the main store, had a big marquee that said, you know, "All things must pass. Thanks, mm-hmm. Sacramento." And that's why the film's called All Things Must Pass. So seriously, check it out. If you go on their website, they have a bunch of different ways you can rent it and watch it on iTunes, on Vimeo, I'm pretty sure Amazon's an option as well. I thought it was a really entertaining, fascinating documentary. And you don't necessarily have to be from Sacramento. In fact, you can be someone like Aaron who openly hates Sacramento and still enjoy
with all my heart. Yeah, it's complete hatred. No, it's a great movie. I mean, it's a really fun documentary. Again, it gives you a peek into the life of a subject that I didn't know much about, and some really fascinating characters, some interesting insights into this world of selling music. It's a really fun journey. There's some awesome pictures in there, and you get some old archival footage from the old days. Really cool stuff. So
yeah,
highly recommend it.
Yeah, me too. Definitely check it out. So now we're going to jump into these five documentary recommendations that we have. Now, you and I shared our list beforehand because we actually didn't want to have any overlaps. We actually wanted to give you 10, you know, different documentaries for you to To go check out, and then we've looked
up 5 good ones for me, and then 5 of some other ones from you.
Some second class fair to Midland documentaries.
All so, Michael Moore documentaries from you.
Because you have a couple on yours that I that were definitely on my made like at least the longer list that could have made my short list. And I have one on. I'm sure I have at least one or two on mine that same for you.
Oh yeah,
and
absolutely.
So we're gonna have 10 to go through. We looked up where you can access these, whether it's on Netflix or you have to rent them somewhere, and so that way we can actually point you in the right direction. These come from all over the place. What's interesting in my 5, I was looking at the years they've come out with. They're mostly recent. I've got 3 that came out in 2014,
wow.
Which is really interesting. And then one in 2012, and then one from 1988. It's not in any order for me. This isn't a top 5. These are just 5 documentaries that I think are underseen, underappreciated. I think there are a couple that certainly that people listening will have heard of, and
I'm hope
sure
so.
Some that they've seen. But it still needs the love. And I'll start off with mine, which is the one from 1988. And I've talked about this on in a couple of past pods. But it's The Thin Blue Line, directed by Errol Morris.
Great choice.
This is the one that's certainly the most prestigious of the ones on my list. I think it's the most famous in the sense that some consider arguably the greatest documentary of all time. I know Sights and Sound poll in like 2014 or 15 had it the 5th best of all time. So it's like in the conversation among like the most culturally and historically significant documentaries. The reason why it's on my list now, one is because it came out in 1988, which means a lot of people, certainly in my age range, will not have had seen this. Maybe heard of it, but will not have seen it. You're a huge Errol Morris fan.
Yeah, so I'm glad that you put this one on there because of all the documentary filmmakers, Errol Morris is my top. I mean, his just thinking of my probably top 5 or 10 documentaries of all time, he's going to occupy at least 5 of those spots. He's what? That good. Yeah, I just love his work. I mean, everything that he does, I'm just fixated on. He shines a light on these interesting characters. He's done it from the very beginning. Characters that at face value probably aren't all that interesting, but once he dives into their thoughts and their minds and their motivations, you see that they're really either twisted or just a little off kilter. He's taken other characters like a Donald Rumsfeld or a McNamara, where you felt like you knew who they were, and maybe as he interviews them, you kind of figure out maybe they weren't as evil as I thought they were. Maybe they were maybe they thought they were really doing the best thing for the country. You know, in those two guys' case.
And but you mentioned to me before we started recording that he actually was a private investigator before he was a filmmaker.
Yeah. So apparently he's that was one of his jobs, and that's and you see it in The Thin Blue Line because he had to dig into these facts. For anyone that doesn't know, Thin Blue Line is a case of a wrongfully convicted guy who kind of got he kind of not set up, but he kind of got railroaded by the system.
Yes.
And Errol Morris goes back and interviews these people that set him up, and he finds these inconsistencies. He finds these flat out lies that they told.
Yeah.
And he puts it all on film, and because of his work, he got this guy off. So.
Yeah, and that's why it's on my list. It's the significance of what I've mentioned in the past with Making a Murderer, with The Jinx, with Serial. Mm-hmm. We're in a craze for this type of stuff, and this is the first, as far as I could really look at and research, it's the first documentary that I can find that's about someone that is at the time of the film of wrongfully convicted and still in prison, an individual, in this case of murder. This guy was convicted of murdering a Dallas police officer, mm-hmm. right? And you, if you kill a cop, I mean, that is there's no way you're getting off. There's no way, or if in this case they thought he killed the cop,
it wasn't. You're not going to get the benefit of the doubt.
Never.
You're looked
never.
As a cop killer from the minute you're arrested.
Yeah,
so.
Yep. It's a bad. That's a bad deal. So, the release of this film directly impacted this guy's case, and he did end up being released, and so from prison. So it had a direct impact on that guy's fate. It's a really, really fascinating story. Mm-hmm. Is it your favorite Errol Morris documentary?
Yeah, it probably is my favorite. It's the first thing that I saw of his. And he was another thing that he's responsible for is the recreation.
Reenactments.
The reenactment style that he used in this film. Before that, it wasn't really done. I guess early in documentaries, it was done a lot. Like Nanook of the North, apparently that's all recreation. But for a long time, it wasn't done. It was, and he kind of brought the style back and he took it to the next level. And now you see it in a ton of documentaries, the recreation or reenactment.
The Jinx, especially, most notably.
Yes, exactly. The Jinx. Or like Touching the Void. Have you seen Touching the Void?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that's all reenactment. And it's directly related to what he did, I think. So you have him to thank for that.
Yeah. Errol Morris is fascinating. He, from what I understand, he shoots occasionally commercials that he's uncredited for, and it's a paycheck, so he can fund these documentaries. Because these documentaries are so good, but there's no way that their studios will finance these, at least completely. There's no way. They're not going to touch them. And so he has to do this work on commercials, which I think is great. He'll shoot this stuff, and then he'll be able to make whatever he wants.
Okay, his best commercial, I think. Have you seen the one that he did for the NFL?
No.
Oh, man. Okay, so the NFL sells these NFL-licensed caskets, okay? So these are caskets that are branded with NFL teams. And so what he did is he found these people that bought these caskets, and he just interviewed them. Like, he said, why did you, he put a camera in front of their face, and they went on to say, my husband or my brother, he was such a huge Cowboys fan, and he died, and this is what he wanted. And it's really fascinating. If you get a chance to find those, look them up. Really cool.
Yeah. Oh, I had no idea. Yeah, I'll definitely check it out. Well, Thin Blue Line, on Rotten Tomatoes, Thin Blue Line is 100%. If we didn't persuade you enough to go see it.
Rightfully so.
The critics are unanimously in favor, and it is available on Netflix right now. You can stream it. So check out Thin Blue Line. What do you got?
So for my first recommendation, I am saying you need to check out the film Senna, which came out in 2010. This is it's a documentary about the life of Ayrton Senna, who is an F1 racer. From Brazil, and this documentary is all archival footage. So it's all like interviews with him, his friends, his family, people that knew him, it's really an intimate look into his life. This is a subject that I had no interest in. I didn't know who Senna was. I just got a recommendation to check out this movie, and they said you're gonna love it even if you don't know who he is, you don't like racing or anything. And they were right. So I went into this movie completely blind, completely cold. And I would say about 20 minutes in, I was sold. Like, it was so riveting, so interesting. He's such a personality. His passion, his desire for perfection. I mean, all these things that made him basically worshipped as a god in Brazil was really fascinating to watch. And anyone who loves sports movies or big personalities, you should definitely check out Senna.
Great. Yeah, it's a great doc. This is certainly one I had on my longer list as well. And probably would have made my top five. I feel like this is one, if anything, people will at least have heard of. It was highly reviewed, and I've had it recommended to me many times before I eventually saw it. But yeah, great. That's a great pick.
Just a real quick note. For me, documentary can be so much more effective than a dramatic film of the same subject or similar subject. Yeah. And I think this is a perfect example. Senna is a way better film than the 2013 movie Rush with Chris Hemsworth.
Did you not like Rush?
I didn't like it. I just thought it was okay. I thought it was so boring, especially in comparison to Senna. So obviously it's different characters. It's and it's a dramatic film. But I just felt like Senna was so much more effective at conveying the message than Rush was.
For me, a more clear example of that would be Man on Wire versus The Walk.
Oh, yeah. I still haven't seen The Walk, so.
Okay, Man on Wire is like one of the greats of all time. I didn't put my list because I'm assuming everyone's seen it, and if you haven't seen it, but yeah.
It's a must see.
Yeah, you didn't have it on your five.
No.
You had it just like me. It's on the long list, but I feel like that one's just super well known, and it should be. Cool. Did you say where it was streaming?
So that one, you can rent it. It's not available for streaming. You can rent it on iTunes for $2.99 or Google Play for $1.99. So.
Oh, okay. Cool. All right. So my next one is a 2014 film called The Overnighters. This is one that was it came to my attention when it was not nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. And it was I was reading some list and it talked about snubs or surprises when they announced the nominations from last year. And they had, you know, The Overnighters listed as a snub for documentary. So I thought, oh, what is this? And I look it up on Rotten Tomatoes. It's 98%. So I didn't know very much at all. I just started watching it, not knowing what the subject matter was about, you know, entirely. And what it is it's about the boom in the oil kind of industry in North Dakota and this mass movement of people going to North Dakota because of the promise of riches and jobs and being able to find and the people that are from all walks of life, whether they're kind of drifters or people that have been out of work for a while and they're just trying to put food on the table and they'll take any job that pays decent money. But the documentary, The Overnighters, is about this happening in this smaller town of Williston, North Dakota. And it's about how these people are getting to this town and realizing there's no room for them and there's certainly no affordable housing for them. And so this local pastor kind of creates this program where he allows these people coming from all over the country to sleep inside the church, much to the chagrin of the actual churchgoers and mm-hmm. the people that live in the town of Williston. And it becomes this huge conflict that gets pretty intense. The movie has a lot to say. And one thing with this film, and not to give away too much, but the beautiful thing about documentaries is you never know what's going to happen when you're making it because you can go in with an idea and the story in mind of what you're trying to document and convey on film. But the fantastic thing about that is there can be a curveball thrown in that no one could have anticipated, and your movie changed a little bit or a lot because of it. And this is a movie that has a curveball. It doesn't change necessarily the message of the film totally, but it's a curveball that really adds a wrinkle that you don't totally expect. And to me, it's incredibly powerful. Now you just recently watched this based on me putting on my list.
Yeah. When you showed me your preliminary list, I said, I got to check this one out. So yeah, I watched it last night and, man, that's a powerful film. It says so much about, America today. And it's kind of a microcosm of what we're dealing with and just some of the issues. You know, it's really scary, actually, how similar it is to some of the bigger discussions we're having, especially with refugees and all
Absolutely.
This talk.
Absolutely.
I mean, you talk about how this pastor, like you said, he's out of the goodness of his heart, out of his convictions, he's opened up his doors to these strangers, to these people that are just coming there, hopefully, to just coming there to work, and they're rejected by everyone, and he's scorned for it. I mean, the local paper has it out for him.
Oh,
it's really
everyone
interesting.
Does. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really interesting. It's a huge target on his back just for doing good work, which is really the fascinating part.
It blows my mind because he's so alone in this battle. And mm-hmm. it's like, it's nice to see someone that appears to have true conviction, mm-hmm. even to the point that there was a moment that I questioned whether or not he was doing something in this particular case that was the best thing for his family. And this was, this was actually dealing with someone that was a registered sex offender. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't allow him to stay in the church. So he has him stay with his family, things like that, where I'm like, well, I mean, this guy's clearly trusting and he's clearly trying to, like live by the principles that he preaches on Sunday. But, like that might not be the best idea,
right? You know, exactly. It's dangerous, and
it is.
When he has the meetings with his parishioners, I mean, you see how torn he is because these are the people that are part of the church, and they don't want those strangers in there. So it's a really interesting documentary, and it's one that anyone who goes to church, I think, would struggle with this type of the message that is being shown there. It's really, really good one. Powerful.
Yeah, it's really powerful. Definitely check it out. So The Overnighters is also streaming on Netflix, so which is great. So seriously, check it out. The Overnighters is worth the watch.
Okay, so the next one on my list would be I'm gonna say The King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters.
Is the next
recommendation. So this one came out in 2007, and it's a documentary about the world of competitive arcade gaming, specifically Donkey Kong. It's the story of a long established champion, Billy Mitchell, versus this upstart outsider, Steve Wiebe. So Billy Mitchell established the ultimate high score in Donkey Kong back in the 80s, and for 20 plus years that record stood until this out of work, I think he's an engineer from Washington, decides to master the game of Donkey Kong. So he builds an arcade in his garage, and he gets laid off from work, and he spends an entire year mastering Donkey Kong, and eventually he gets the highest score of all time. And he submits the score to the official gaming body, and who Billy Mitchell is involved with, and it causes a huge uproar in the community because this guy's an outsider. No one's ever heard of him before, and everyone that's in that gaming community is basically a sycophant of Billy Mitchell. I mean, they're a lackey that does his bidding. And so when this outsider comes into it, he ruffles many, many feathers.
Oh yeah,
and to the point where people scheme, and they call him a cheater, and they say that they don't believe that he actually broke this record. It's really an interesting documentary. It takes a lot of twists and turns, and you have this Billy Mitchell is like the ultimate villain character. It's really interesting because he's like this alpha male surrounded by these beta males who are the rest of the gaming community, and he's like the baddest dog on the block. But really, if you see him, he kind of looks like a loser. I mean, he's the king of the hot sauce in Hollywood, Florida. So Steve Wiebe is this he's this really reserved, emotional, laid back father of two, and you know, he goes on this journey to be the ultimate Donkey Kong player, and he gets it. He gets the championship. But like I said, his score is disqualified, and it really takes a toll on him emotionally. You can see that it puts a strain on his family, his wife. His wife is really cool because she's so supportive of him.
Yeah.
You can tell that she's just annoyed.
Yeah. Well, wouldn't anybody be?
Yeah, exactly. But it's a really interesting journey. It's fun. It's funny. There's some funny characters and some really devious characters. And it's an interesting look into this world of competitive gaming that I didn't know existed. So
this documentary is definitely in my top five of all time. And I would have had it, you know, you have it on your list, so I took it off mine. It's the the most rewatchable documentary of all time, in my opinion.
It's up there. It's definitely up there.
I could watch it over and over again and get just so much entertainment out of it, because the people who made this struck gold with Billy Mitchell as this just openly villainous person. And what's crazy is these are like I've filmed a lot of people in interview settings and in otherwise, and the awareness of a camera being on you does things to the mind and to a human, and they're very, very aware of their actions. Mm-hmm. And Billy Mitchell could have easily tried to not appear like a total a-hole, and he doesn't.
He plays it up. He loves it. He loves the spotlight. He loves to be the villain, and he's a bully. He's an absolute bully. So funny to watch.
So he's the director strikes gold with Billy Mitchell, and he strikes gold with the fact that Steve Wiebe is an incredibly likable individual.
Yeah,
like,
he
has a hero that is a guy out of a job. He's us. He represents the people that you want him to win and succeed against, this evil, terrible person who's cheating and has had it at least appears like financial success. And we'll do whatever it takes to, you know, whatever devious means to maintain his Donkey Kong championship status.
Right. One of the things that really strikes me is when they're interviewing the people in Billy's life, like his parents or his friends, they all say that he's a winner. Like, that's the one message that they all convey, that Billy is a winner. He's an achiever. If he sets his mind to do something, he gets it. It's like... It's like he programmed them to say these things. It's so funny.
Yeah, it's... Well, and that's, you know, one of my favorite scenes is what you referenced at the very beginning of this pod is the kill screen or whatever it was.
Yeah, the Donkey Kong kill screen.
Oh, my gosh. That guy running around this little arcade letting every single person know that Steve Wiebe is about to have a Donkey Kong kill screen. And it was like the biggest moment of this guy's life.
One of the underrated things is Steve Wiebe, his name is spelled W-E-I-B-E. And for some reason, the people that are involved with the scoring committee, they pronounce it Weeb. And they do it so often that he gets annoyed with it. Mm-hmm. And he corrects them. It's just a funny little moment.
Yeah, this is one that, I mean, if I'm going to tell anyone, this has the highest entertainment value of any of the ones we're going to go on our list.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It's not going to be necessarily the most important in terms of, like, bringing knowledge to a certain... either what cause or crisis of any kind, but it will give you, this is the best example of how real life is more fascinating than narrative fiction.
Definitely.
This is so entertaining. So what a great pick.
And that one is available for streaming on Hulu Plus, and you can also rent it on iTunes for $3.99. So
yeah, if you don't have Hulu Plus, it's worth the $3.99 iTunes. Cool. My next one is, 2014 film called Finding Vivian Maier. This is a film that I kind of had stumbled into at this independent theater here in Utah called the Broadway Cinema. And it had good reviews as a documentary, and I forgot I was doing that day, but I had some time and I figured I'd go check it out. It was 95% Rotten Tomatoes, so it caught my attention. And it's this incredible documentary. Unfortunately, it's not available for streaming anywhere. You can only buy it on iTunes for $12.99. And I'm sure you could probably buy the DVD on Amazon for much less. Digitally, there's no rental, which is really odd. But just the basic gist of the film is about this guy. And this is what I love. This is the type of thing I would want to happen to me and to make a documentary about it. But this dude, who's a, you know, a younger filmmaker, probably someone closer to my age, but in his late 20s, that's... he's working on some historical project of some kind. I mean, he's a photographer and a filmmaker, and he goes to this auction where he buys this, these auctions of essentially of like a bunch of junk and stuff, but there's a box of tons of film negatives. Now he's not able to see what's on them. He bids and he wins. He spends like $300 to get this enormous box of negatives. And he starts going through them, hoping this will help whatever project it is that he's working on. And what he discovers are these photographs taken by what he eventually learns to be this woman named Vivian Maier. But these photographs are like master class photography. It's like incredibly well shot photos. Like it looked like it was a reel from a professional photographer that went out and shot a bunch of stuff. And he's going through thinking, what is this? Like who took these photos? These are incredible photos. And so the documentary is him trying to figure out who this woman was, in which, you know, early on, this woman essentially is a nanny. She's not from America. I believe it's somewhere in Europe. But she came over and was a nanny for several different people throughout Chicago and some other places. And she would take out the kids that she was taking care of. And they would walk around these downtown areas, and she would have this camera around her neck, and she'd be shooting photos the whole time. And she was a world-class photographer that never actually had any type of notoriety or fame or anything at all, and was an incredibly private woman. And, you know, this is after, you know, he discovers these things after she's passed away. And the movie is his discovery to try to figure out who she was. How was she so good at this? Was she ever famous? Was she ever known for doing this? And so it's called Finding Vivian Maier. And Vivian or Maier is M-A-I-E-R. So Google it. Check out the trailer. Incredible film. Like I said, 95% Rotten Tomatoes. It was nominated for Best Documentary Oscar in 2014. So.
Yeah, that's really cool. It's a really interesting subject. I read something about it a long time ago, and I'm glad that they made a documentary about it.
So it just goes along with the theme I'm talking about of just everyday people that can do extraordinary things, and that's what's most interesting to me. So
yeah. And that one has the added element of it being like a hidden treasure, like this guy discovered a buried treasure somewhere just by buying a lot at at an auction. It's really, yeah, it's, really fascinating. Yeah,
it's, I mean, it's incredible. This guy finds the kid, the grown-up children that were nannied by her, and hearing the stories of her, and it's really, really, really engrossing film.
Yeah. So. Very cool. I'm going to check that one out, so.
Cool.
The next one on my list is it's a documentary called Another State of Mind. It's from 1984. And this is a music documentary. It's all based around these two up-and-coming punk bands from L.A. or the L.A. area, Youth Brigade and Social Distortion.
Oh.
So, yeah, this is a cross-country tour about these two bands. And they're going from L.A. Up through Canada, and then they're going to back around to the East Coast. So this documentary film crew followed them on this journey. This was actually the first U.S. tour for Social Distortion. It's funny to see these guys is so young. I mean, they're 18 and 19 years old. And in 1984 that's kind of like the end of the second wave of punk. So it's kind of like the birth of the hardcore movement type of that era. Mm. So it's really fascinating. For me, this is a movie that I watched when I was a kid, and I was huge into the punk scene. That's all I listened to when I was a kid in high school. So this one, this was right up my alley. And this movie is one that I watched I seriously watched this movie like once a week for maybe 3 years.
Wow.
And it's really entertaining. Like, that's the key. Like, it's not just a story about these punk bands on tour. There's really fascinating characters involved. And, along the journey, it's not just focused on the bands. The filmmakers actually, talk to the people that are in the scene. So you get these 18, 20-year-old kids who are talking about what they love about this music, what they love about the scene. They're talking about the philosophy involved, what moves them, what motivates them, and how they feel marginalized, basically, by normal, typical society. And so if you watch the interviews now, a lot of the things that they're saying, it still applies today to kids. So I feel like it's a timeless watch, and it's something you can relate to. And yeah, it's fun to see them, you know, kids in 80s dressed up like, you know, typical punk rockers and with the mm-hmm. bad hairstyles and stuff. So on that end, it's really funny to watch. But it's really fascinating as well. As anyone that loves music, I think this is the type of documentary that you'll find interesting.
Yeah, that's now you said it was 84?
Yeah, 84. Yep.
I only make that distinction because there's multiple films titled this.
Yeah, so this one's 1984, Another State of Mind. And this one's actually not available for streaming. You can only get it in the physical copy. So
great.
It's awesome. It's a little bit hard to find, but it's worth it. So, especially if you're a Social Distortion fan or if you're an 80s punk fan, definitely awesome. Check it out. Yeah.
Well, my next one is a music documentary as well. Before I go into that, though, you mentioning the hair, I was going to make this comment about the overnighters because it's one of my favorite moments, and it might even be in the trailer. The guys that are staying in the parking lot and inside this church in North Dakota, one of them has got like long hair and this like mm-hmm. I think it's a beard. You know, he is not like well kept in that sense. And the pastor tells him, like, you know, you're gonna have to cut your hair, like, just because the people, like, everyone's gonna look suspiciously at you with like long hair and a big old beard. And the dude remarks, like, well, didn't Jesus have long hair? And the pastor's like, Jesus didn't have our neighbors. You know, it's fun, it's hilarious, but it's also like a really it's also a serious moment in that film. Sorry,
it's not to rewind,
funny. yeah,
that was a good moment.
The Overnighters is, definitely check it out. But, okay, music documentaries. Mine is the last of the 2014 films on my list. It's called Mistaken for Strangers. So, not super well-known. It's got a 91% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it is available to rent on iTunes for $3.99 or $2.99 if you can watch it in standard definition. Mistaken for Strangers is a fascinating movie. It's a musical doc because it's about the band The National, which is actually a band I was not familiar with before I watched the film. They appear to be fairly significant, and they have a big fan base, a big following. I recognized one of their songs when I was watching the documentary because it's the very last, like the closing song of the film Warrior, a movie that I love. And so, like, pivotal moment of that film. The very end is set to just the song playing, and it's actually a song by The National. So the documentary is about the brother, actually, of the lead singer. So the lead singer is a guy named Tom, I believe it's Berenger, and he's the lead singer of The National. He's this rock star. Their band's getting huge, and they're about to go on this global, this international tour, and he has a little brother that is kind of he still lives at home with his parents. This guy's in his 30s, and he's kind of like the unsuccessful son that's kind of not motivated to work and wants to be a filmmaker, but he's not really, not super good at it, and he's not really doing anything about it. And so the older brother, out of, the whole, I guess, brotherly instincts, while also being pressured by his parents to allow his little brother to come on the tour as a roadie and to help, set up and whatnot. His brother brings his camera with him and decides to make a kind of behind the scenes documentary about the whole tour, which is like totally not what anyone in the band had signed up for or wanted at all. What you get is a really interesting film, because it ends up not being what he set out for it to be, because his little brother is, while he's like kind of lovable, he's also, you can see how annoying and grating he is on his older brother's personality, and he's trying so hard because no one in the band wants him there. No one in the crew wants him there. The dude's not working hard. He's not helping in any way, and he's filming people when they don't want to be filmed. But it's like this screw-up little brother that is frustrated by how his brother's the rock star and everyone loves him. And what he ends up cutting is a film that is really about family. It's about, it's about a lot of things. I don't want to interpret the themes I took out of it necessarily, but it's a very affecting, funny, heartfelt, genuine film from the perspective of this kind of screw up little brother. Again, I think everyone will probably take a little bit of a different thing away from it. I don't want to give away too much in terms of, not that it's a twist, but the perspective that it ends up having, the film, it's really, really fascinating. But it's got, well, I'm not a huge fan of the type of music, but it's got, it's certainly a music doc in that sense. But it's about family more than anything. I mean, the National, I guess they helped in Barack Obama's reelection campaign, and so there is a scene where they get to meet Obama because they were the headliners at one of the concerts that was for his campaign. And that's kind of a crucial scene because the little brother really wants to meet Obama too. And so he includes himself as if he's going to go, and his brother has to break it to him that that's not going to happen. The Secret Service had not approved him to be among the group that went in to meet him, and that's a cause of contention in the film. Like, why do you get to meet Obama and I don't? It's really, really fascinating. But yeah, check out Mistaken for Strangers. I almost don't want to say any more than that, just because I think people deserve to go in with a pretty open mind and get out of it what they will. So yeah, that's
yeah. I watched the trailer for that one when I saw it on your list, and it looks really, really interesting. It's funny, in the trailer, the brother shows that he's in a record store and he's flat out telling the people that work there that I'm the brother of the lead singer of The National.
Yeah, yeah,
and they couldn't be
less interested,
less impressed. They could just couldn't care less.
Yeah. I mean, cause it's not like the Rolling Stones. It's not like, it's not like he's at that point. The National certainly had a fan base, but like not everyone would have heard of them.
And also the way that he's carrying himself is just like, he seems like a clown. So he probably wouldn't even believe him. So
no, he's totally a clown. And that's what's so funny is you're getting it from his perspective, and he's annoying. He's like definitely
seems like
annoying.
It. Yeah. He seems like it.
Yeah. But then you really start to feel for him. You really do. It's pretty authentic. It's good. It's good. So.
All right. So the next one on my list is Happy People, A Year in the Taiga. And this is a documentary co-directed by Werner Herzog and some other Russian director. I can't pronounce his name.
But for those of you who don't know Werner Herzog, he had a few cameo appearances in the last season of Parks and Rec. You might know him from that.
Yes, exactly. That's where you'll know him from. Yeah, so Herzog, I'm a big fan of his work. Obviously, Grizzly Man is one of the great documentaries you should ever see if you come across it. For this movie, it's It's set in a desolate 300-person village in the heart of Siberia. So this is just a small town that is completely cut off from the modern-day world. And the film primarily follows this fur trapper for 12 months. And you get to see all the traditions, all the culture that's involved in this little community. And you get to see this fur trapper, how he really kind of shuns modern technology except for a snowmobile. Other than that, I mean, he just does things the old-fashioned way. So he's setting traps that that his grandfather and his grandfather's grandfather set, and it's the same exact technology. And he uses it to this day because it's so much more effective than anything else out there. And so over the course of the documentary, you get to really appreciate how this fur trapper, how he lives his daily life. It's a very simple life. He's a hard worker. There's no time for laziness. He actually looks down on these other trappers that don't do things the right way, that are just out for a buck. And you see how it's a methodical life, and it's very difficult. I mean, we're talking about physical labor every single day in extreme temperatures. And this guy never complains. There isn't a moment where he ever considers complaining. All it is I have to do it. So he's ultimately motivated. I mean, he is he's someone that he just does things the way they have to be done, and he doesn't think for a second. He doesn't consider whether he should do them. He just knows that he has to get them done. And it's really fascinating to look into his life. You see that the life of a trapper is very hard. I mean, it is not something that I could ever consider doing. There are some light moments in it, too. Like he has this dog, or this family of dogs that he uses to help him with his work. And you can tell that they're not just looked at as like tools. I mean, he has a real companionship with these animals. And so that's really a kind of like a light moment. But it's really interesting look into the lifestyle of these people that, you know, they live like this timeless lifestyle that could happen at any point in the past 200 years. I mean, there's nothing about them that is modern. So it's really interesting. And you can actually stream that on Amazon. It's streaming on Amazon Prime. So.
Oh, okay. So if you have a Prime account, you can watch it for free. Is that?
Yep. Yep.
Which is everybody, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Amazon is not a sponsor of this pod, but I will say Amazon Prime is one of the better deals, one of the more no-brainer deals out
there. Oh, unquestionably, yeah.
Yeah, but it also causes me to be extremely vulnerable after midnight, as I was telling you. That one click to purchase button is like my kryptonite.
Well, do you want to tell the people what you bought?
Well,
one click.
I was showing Aaron this before we started recording, but I made a late night purchase.
It's very practical.
Yeah, well, I figured I could use it in certain situations to great effect. But I bought an exact prop replica of the First Order Stormtrooper helmet from The Force Awakens. It's exactly the ones from the film, and it was not cheap. but it looks awesome.
It really
and
does.
So can't wait for October to roll around. That'll be great. It's
good choice.
Halloween. tell me the name again of that last film.
Yeah, it's called Happy People: A Year in the Taiga.
Okay, so it's Taiga. Okay, so it's not Tiger, and you were saying it kind of.
No.
Okay.
T A I G A.
Okay, got it. Awesome. Cool. Well, my last film then is a film that I championed for a long time. I saw it at the Sundance Film Festival when it was first screened, and of course, it wasn't released till 6 months later. I told, you know, this happens every now and then. I see a movie that I feel like it's not going to reach a very broad audience, at least initially. That I just like, I will really, really champion it. And this is, people who know me know I was talking about this film for forever. To try to talk people into it. Eventually, I feel like it was on Netflix for a while. It's not anymore, but it is on Crackle for free with ads. So you can watch it there, but it's Searching for Sugar Man. And I feel like it certainly broke into the mainstream, and I feel it did win the documentary, documentary. It won the Oscar for Best Documentary in 2013. And so I feel like a lot of people have heard of it. But because of my deep and abiding love to this film, I don't want to leave anything to chance, which is why I have it as my, you know, final entry. Searching for Sugar Man, 94% Rotten Tomatoes. Really, 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 really great film. And to give just the, I guess the short synopsis. Don't watch a trailer to it. I will say that much. You want to go into this one and just enjoy the experience. And the basic gist of it is there's this this kind of this folk type music. This artist from the 70s named Rodriguez that made a couple of records and was really, really talented. And he kind of got with a label, but he never sold any records in the United States. Wasn't popular at all. But his kind of anti-government, anti-establishment kind of theme of his music really resonated in South Africa, where a copy had made it of his record, had made it down there, and it kind of blew up in South Africa. Unfortunately, the Rodriguez by that time had committed suicide, and so he never knew that his music had taken off, right? Like he died thinking he was never a success. So the film is about some South Africans that try to get to the bottom of who Rodriguez was. And a lot of, I feel like that's, it sounds similar to Finding Vivian Maier and some of those other ones.
About, yeah, I was really gonna say it actually has an interesting parallel to that.
So. It really does, yeah. So it's investigating who he was. You know, how was he so good but not at all popular in America, especially during a time when that music should have been a hit. And also the reasons why he committed suicide. Like what was this? And there's some discrepancy of exactly how he died. And so there's an element there about figuring out what exactly happened. And so it's Searching for Sugar Man. Sugar Man's a track on one of the records. And it's really an incredible investigative journey. And it's such a fun thing to watch, made all the more fun by the fact that his music's actually really good. Mm-hmm. And I listen to his album, you know, all the time now. I mean, it's I actually really like his music. And so it's for those two reasons, the music and this incredible story, it's a must-see doc. So
yeah, it's a good choice. I like that one a lot. Where can we see that one?
Yeah, so that's Crackle. That's the one with,
Crackle.
Yeah, right, with the ads. So
all right. I think I should watch that one again because it's so good. It's been a while. Yeah.
No, it's really, really great. So you are going to finish us off with your last one.
My very last one, my last recommendation is a movie from 1999, and it's a documentary called American Movie. And this one, it's about this guy who lives in Wisconsin, and he
I'm in.
Yeah, exactly. So you have the if you wanted a prequel to the Making a Murderer series.
Yeah, is this in Manitowoc County?
No, it's not, but they talk exactly the same. So yeah, it's about this guy who is a passionate movie fan. I mean, he's read all these books, he's watched all the movies, he is in love with cinema, and the only problem is he's not very talented. He's really, really untalented, and he has no way to get to Los Angeles. So he decides to make movies in his hometown, and he casts his friends, and he casts people that are around him, and they're also bad. But he's so passionate about it that he makes it work, kinda. And so this is all about the journey that he goes through to make his vision become a reality, his dream become a reality. And over the course of learning about him and his history, you find that he's also a pretty big screw up. Probably an alcoholic, got kicked out of the army, not the most dependable guy, but he loves film. And that's one of the things that I love about this movie, is he is a dreamer, and his number one passion in life is making movies. So this is a movie that I saw when I was in high school, and it made me want to make movies.
Really?
Yeah, because you see a guy that has no business making films doing it. I mean, he just goes out and he rents a camera, and he gets people that kind of know what they're doing, puts them in the spot, and they just execute. And the, you know, he makes some interesting films, but they're not good. So, yeah. But he doesn't care. He just does it anyway. He's kind of like Ed Wood. I don't know if you have you seen the Ed Wood movie, Tim Burton. Yeah. Okay, so he's kind of like Ed Wood in that sense. He just has a vision, and he makes it happen. And even though he's a screw-up, and even though his friends don't know what they're doing, they make it happen. So it's kind of like the American dream.
So what year did that come out again?
1999.
99.
Yeah.
And it's called American Movie.
Yeah, it's called American Movie. It's streaming on Crackle as well.
Oh, okay.
So you can watch that. No ads.
Crackle really came through for us.
They sure did. Thank you, Crackle. This episode is brought to you by Crackle.
Yeah, it is actually brought to you. And the only way you can listen to this episode is by is through the ads on Crackle, streaming on Crackle. That's fascinating. I have not seen that.
No,
that
you
film.
Should see it. You'll love it. You'll relate.
I hadn't
to
even
a lot.
Heard of it. You know, until it was on your list. So.
So back in the '90s when it came out, it actually had a pretty big run. It was pretty popular.
Yeah.
But since then, it's kind of fallen out of favor.
Okay.
Yeah. These guys are definitely small town thinkers. They love the Packers, which is pretty funny.
Yeah.
Like, there's several scenes where they're watching Packer games. And there's just a lot of characters, man. And it's funny to see these small town guys have big dreams. So.
Yeah. Well, awesome.
So check out American Movie.
Great. Well, there's 10 documentaries for people to go see.
Yeah.
If you were going to pick one of those five, if you wanted to lead off, like start with this one, if you only have time, maybe even for one immediately, which one are you going to recommend?
So number one would be The King of Kong.
Okay.
Fistful of Quarters. Yeah. Just because it's kind of a short documentary and it flows, really has really good pacing. And I think it's probably the most entertaining of all of those. So I would say start off with that one.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. I think King of Kong. Can that be mine as well? I tell people go see King of Kong.
There's a sequel. I haven't seen it, but I've heard there's a sequel.
Oh.
Yeah.
For King of Kong?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, there is. I don't know what it's about or anything. I have no interest in seeing. I just want those characters to stop right there.
This is the thing about the King of Kong is, or King of Kong, whatever. It doesn't even matter where they end up in terms of who has the record. Like, people, you can look it up on Wikipedia and it's changed like 10 more times. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who currently holds it or whatever. Like, it's about that moment in time and who held the record then and what was going on.
Yeah.
That I don't really care. I don't really care beyond that, the confines of that film, what happens.
No, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. As far as I'm concerned, whoever ends up with a record in the movie, I'm not going to say who does, but whoever ends up with that record is the champion.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's exactly right. And that's really, really that's the champion in the minds of everyone that watches it.
Yeah.
So there's been a rumored narrative, like an adaptation of the documentary to be a narrative
fiction.
I hope
not.
Yeah, I know. It's the worst idea ever because there's no way to improve on the story being told in the documentary. It's too good.
Well, unless they actually cast Billy Mitchell as Billy Mitchell.
I mean, which maybe. He's in. He'd be down to do that.
He has to be.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that'd be so great. We let him write all his own lines, too. Oh, that'd be so good. Oh, Billy Mitchell.
He's the greatest.
Well, I would encourage people to see the Thin Blue Line certainly for the historical perspective and all that stuff. I think that would be the one I would have to push forward.
It's a very good choice.
Yeah, yeah. So, but all five of those are ones, you know, obviously I feel strongly about, and you've got five great ones as well. So I'm excited to see. There's a couple of those ones that I definitely haven't seen, the Taiga one and the American Movie especially.
Yeah, I'm going to have to mail you my copy of Another State of Mind. So I hope that you have a VCR somewhere.
All right, I'll be ready. So, all right, well, we're going to bring you on next for this Cohen pod here. We're going to nail it down in time. We're going to do it this week. I went through their filmography recently, seeing the one, of course, there are going to be a handful I haven't seen. I've seen the recent ones, but I haven't seen Barton Fink, and I haven't seen Miller's Crossing. So,
oh, man.
I know Miller's Crossing. I don't have to watch before I do it. So
yeah,
that's the one I've got queued up ready to go. So, are there any that you outstanding ones that you haven't seen other than Hail Caesar?
There probably are.
Yeah.
It's just not coming to me at the moment, but I've seen most of the big ones. So
okay,
I'll definitely give them a rewatch at some point.
Well, don't bother rewatching Lady Killers. Burn After Reading. We'll talk about that in the next part.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, dude, thanks, man. Thanks for joining me on Super Bowl Sunday to talk documentaries.
Go Broncos.
Yeah,
just
right?
Kidding.
Go,
I hate the Broncos.
Go Broncos. It was the most boring sporting event I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
And until the reaction shot of Eli Manning looking thoroughly disappointed that his brother was going to tie him for a number of Super Bowl wins.
I'm hoping that there's a documentary there. Maybe Eli does the whole he makes a documentary of his brother.
Dude, Oh, the shop. Everyone around him is cheering, and Eli just looks just like heartbroken. Like, I mean, he looks so devastated. The look of like, I almost did it. I almost had it. I was almost I was gonna be forever like in immortality. I was going to be better than Peyton. I'd be able to hang over his head that I'd won more Super Bowl than him, that I had more success, more championships. No.
Sorry, Eli. Oh, hey, did you see the thing on Twitter that Marshawn Lynch retired? Did you see that?
I saw him post that he had hung his shoes over some power lines. I don't know what that means. He also had the peace sign.
That's it. And that's how he retired. So I'm thinking when you retire from this podcast, all you should do is post the peace sign and then a picture of your microphone wrapped around the telephone wire.
Right. That's how I want to send in my resignation for any part of my career in my life. When I actually retire, I want to do that. It's like a keyboard.
Right. Well, when you're sitting on $50 million, I guess you can do whatever you want. Like Lynch is. So.
Marshawn Lynch sent that in the middle of the Super Bowl, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant.
I love. Like what? Like he couldn't have waited a day?
No. He doesn't care. He just doesn't care.
I bet he was so bored like the rest of us that he's like, I'll give him something to be talk about, something to be excited about. Here you go. I'm done. Well, whatever makes Seattle worse, I'm fine by it. So fascinating dude, though.
Very much so. Let's get him on the podcast.
Yeah, we can get him. Let's get him.
He's not busy now, so.
No, yeah. He's got all the time in the world. And I hear he loves to, you know, talk into microphones into the public. All right. Well, I think let's sign off. I think it's time for bed. You got some Kobe highlights to watch tonight. Did they play today?
You know, I don't think so.
What's funny though, is he's actually had a string. He's pulled together a string of pretty decent performances.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we almost beat the Spurs. So,
hey, that'll be his legacy. He'll be remembered for that. All right.
15 win season.
Go watch Hail Caesar, and all right, we'll get Skylar on, and we'll talk Coen Brothers later this week. So,
all right, thanks for having me.
The rest of you, thanks for listening. Go watch
DawnOfTheThread.com.
What's that?
DawnOfTheThread.com. Go there.
Oh yeah, DawnOfTheThread.com is where you can actually view. We're gonna be streaming all 10 of these documentaries. Mm-hmm. If they're not up yet, we're still working on it. Just buy a T-shirt in the meantime. Eventually, we'll get them up.
There's also a new T-shirt in the works of David wearing the Stormtrooper mask. So.
Can you have it with the red blood hand mark, like, oh, yeah, like Finn's friend had?
Definitely.
Shot by Poe.
Okay. Limited edition.
Yeah, that'd be great. Well, terrific. Take it easy. Oh, shout out to our friends, the NSA, this podcast is brought to you by the NSA, of the United States government. Huge fans of the pod. Thanks for listening in. I know it's kind of it took a while to get your attention, but we did what it took to come up on your radar. I'm glad we did. So, as we say,
hold on to your butts.
Perfect. Hey, man, have a good night.
You too. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Brave Little Podcast. Hold on to your butts.